Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.
Hello, and welcome to That's Life, Spectator Life's sideways look through the confines of your kitchen window at what's left of the outside world today. I'm Benedict Spence.
And I'm Andy Shaw.
And on this podcast, we'll be poking fun at the people, words, and ideas that have popped up in the news over the past few weeks. Unsurprisingly, a lot of them revolve around an ailment that starts with the letter C. That's right, after over a month of lockdown, cabin fever has truly set in, and the bickering that this nation became renowned for in the wake of Brexit has begun again in earnest. The latest narrative to have emerged around the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who has been away from the front lines with a bout of coronavirus, is that through a cunning, conniving scheme, he manipulated a whole pandemic by deliberately catching the disease and stage-managing a Christ-like resurrection just to get a bump in the polls. It must be tiring being an evil genius of that kind of magnitude. I think I'd need a few weeks off at Checkers too, if I'd thought of that. On the subject of evil geniuses, our guest for this episode is social commentator and founder of the Free Speech Union, Toby Young. Toby, who is also the author of How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, which, despite what you may think, was not a foreshadowing of the rise of Jeremy Corbyn, recently tried his hand at stand-up comedy, and then described the experience in his Spectator column as a bit like someone who wakes up from a general anaesthetic in the middle of their operation. Well, I suppose if he'd done that a few weeks later, the ward that he woke on would have at least had a ventilator to help him breathe and calm the nerves a little bit. Toby, it's very nice to have you with us. How are you enjoying lockdown?
I wouldn't say I'm enjoying it, but I'm surviving. I think I had a bout of coronavirus towards the beginning of lockdown. I was bedridden for a week, had some but not all of the symptoms, but my wife contends that I didn't, in fact, have COVID-19. I just went down with a bout of shingles brought on by the stress of worrying about getting COVID-19. And she also thinks that there was an element of trying to avoid the increased housework as a result of being confined at home with four children who aren't at school. But I still maintain that I've had it, but I've now made a full recovery.
Well, that's good to hear. And just on the subject of your stand-up, have you got any plans to get back up on stage after lockdown has ended? Or was that enough for you, that one botched operation?
Well, I said to Andy after I completed my set and felt, in all modesty, that it had gone over reasonably well, I said to Andy, you know, how about I come back and do another one in a few months' time? And he looked slightly discombobulated and started kind of shuffling around in a kind of slightly shifty way and said, well, we do sometimes have people back at Christmas, but you only get to do like about 30 seconds, but perhaps we could talk about that. That was the extent of my getting invited back. So I'm not sure if I'm ever going to do it again. The ball is in Andy's court.
If only you would have asked me that question when the COVID happened, I'd have had the perfect excuse. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you know, but you started a bit of a trend. Now, I don't know when we're going to have the next live show because that's in Boris and other people's hands, but Maurice Glassman, the author, the sort of architect of Blue Labour, saw your show and said, well, if he can get up there, can I? And I said, of course you can, Maurice. You're welcome, mate. So I think you started a bit of a trend there, Toby.
Oh, well, that's good. I'll let me know when Maurice is going to be up there and I'll come along and I'd like to see him.
And you're welcome back as well yourself.
Now, Toby, you've been a vocal critic of the government's COVID-19 lockdown strategy. Is there anything that's particularly stood out to you or perhaps even humoured you about the government's response so far?
Yeah, I started a website called covidskeptics.org, which has become a kind of hub where people who are sceptical about the effectiveness of the lockdown gather, share information, point out papers and interesting articles to one another. And I do a daily update, which is actually, it's beginning to take increasingly large amounts of time. So it takes me now all morning to do the daily update. And then I'm spending most afternoons thinking about what I'm going to put in the following day's daily update and also updating the various different threads across the site. So it's become almost my full-time job during lockdown, maintaining this hub. But yeah, you ask an interesting question. I mean, one of the things which stood out recently, I don't know if you, how closely you've been following it, Ben, but the World Health Organization hasn't emerged from the crisis covered in glory. And I have some sympathy with Donald Trump's announcement that he's going to no longer pay them hundreds of millions of dollars a year. They started out claiming that there was no human-to-human transmission, faithfully echoing the propaganda line of the Chinese authorities. And then when they acknowledged that there was human-to-human transmission, they then praised the Chinese authorities for their efficient management of the outbreak. Now, I don't know if you know, but the Chinese management of the outbreak included imprisoning all those who tested positive in special purpose-built hospitals, whether they required hospital care or not. And for those who tested negative, at least in Wuhan and surrounding areas, they literally boarded them up in their homes and wouldn't release them for 2 weeks. Now, according to the WHO, that was a model of how to manage this outbreak. They've committed a number of other kind of absurd own goals. But most recent, one of the senior panjendrums at the WHO actually praised Sweden as a model of how to manage the outbreak. Now, Sweden is an outlier in that Sweden hasn't actually imposed a lockdown. The chief epidemiologist advising the Swedish government initially said, no, we don't need to lock down. What we're doing now, mitigation, is perfectly adequate. If we lock the people down, that'll just be an unnecessary act of economic self-harm, and there could be horrendous public health consequences. We trust our people to observe the more modest social distancing measures we've imposed. Let's stick to that plan, and God bless him. God bless the Swedish government. They have stuck to that plan, and their death rate is far, far lower than ours. And the number of deaths and infections in Sweden is declining in a very similar way to the way it's declining in those countries that have locked down. But curiously, after having praised the Chinese reaction, which couldn't have been more draconian or extreme or totalitarian, the WHO have now decided that actually Sweden got it right, and that this much more modest, socially democratic approach to managing the outbreak was the right one all along.
It's funny, isn't it? We've all got so many questions about what is going on. And I must admit, I've stopped watching the Daily Update and I cannot watch the news anymore. I find it utterly unbearable, partly because all the questions that are asked by the media commentators are... It's almost like a herd mentality of, you know, one day it's all PPE and the next day it's all about care homes. And there seems to be no sort of intelligent questioning going on that's broader. The thing I'd love to see is the Swedish epidemiologist that you mentioned there, Toby, debating Niall Ferguson about the two different models. Because, you know, I've read that, you know, Ferguson wrote the code for this model that he's using 13 years ago. And I think he was also responsible for the modelling around BSE and SARS and MERS and various different things. So, you know, there's lots of history with him. But actually, this is a highly contested area, just like any computer modelling is. It's all based on the assumptions that you put in, which is based on your, you know, your history and what you've learned, and also, you know, personal inputs and influences that you have. So it's a very human thing, the assumptions that you build into something, partly based on your experience. But everybody has those different approaches, and it's a very contested area. And I can't, and unless I'm looking in the wrong place. And I do read your blog, which is actually very interesting, because you're taking a skeptical position. But there doesn't seem to be a public discussion around what's right and wrong about what we're doing. It seems to be all about blame. You know, it's like, almost like gotcha politics, rather than intelligent discussion and treating us like adults.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think trying to apportion blame for the UK's apparently high death toll at this juncture is just political nonsense. We won't know how many excess deaths there have been in the UK until the end of the year. We won't know how they compare with the five-year average of excess deaths, whether they're greater than a bad bout of seasonal flu or not. You know, there are so many unknowns in all of this. We really don't know whether the lockdown that Boris imposed on March 23rd has had any effect at all in lowering the death toll. It might have actually increased the death toll, given the impact on public health. The government itself estimated that something like 150,000 people may die who wouldn't otherwise have died from non-COVID diseases because of the way in which COVID-19 patients have been prioritised by the NHS, and because people have been frightened to go to their doctors because they don't want to burden the NHS because of this kind of government mantra about protecting the NHS trotted out over and over again. You're perfectly right. I mean, that often the government will fall back on the excuse that it's following the science. So if it turns out it has made any poor decisions, it will blame the scientists. But as you say, the science is a slightly misleading phrase, because there isn't a hard and fast objective consensus about what the best way to manage this crisis is. Epidemiologists, like every other academic field disagree. And when they disagree passionately. And you're right, the chief epidemiologist of Sweden has been taking shots at Niels Ferguson, who's been responding in kind. They've been doing it kind of across the North Sea rather than in person. It would be much better if they were to do it in person. We've been joking on Lockdown Skeptics that when this is all over, Tarantino should make a movie about the kind of ongoing war between epidemiologists. And some of the readers have suggested titles like Science Czar Dogs, Public Health Fiction, and Once Upon a Time in Wuhan.
I would pay a lot of money to see that last film made. I do think it's very interesting. I mean, I read James Forsyth's excellent column in The Spectator last week, where he said that the government was waking up to the realisation that when they say the science, it's perhaps not as clear-cut as they've been led to believe. It's closer to economics than it is to, say, physics. And also the other thing that they said, of course, was they're also finding out that epidemiologists are every bit as bitchy as economists are as well. There's a real lack of friendliness there between them. But I was just, before we move on, what do you think has been the public's response to this? Because we get lots of different competing narratives about actually how the public are very much in favour of the lockdown, but also there's this great worry that people are going to sort of, you know, lose patience with it and burst forth into the streets if they aren't given a deadline. Do you think that there's much store in that? Do you think that the public are, you know, sort of cleaving to authoritarianism, or do you think that they're actually ready to be let out?
Yeah, it's hard to predict. The polling indicates that the British people are far more enthusiastic about being placed under virtual house arrest than almost any other people in the world. You know, in Germany, there have been pretty riotous protests in cities like Berlin. There have been protests in Belgium. There have been protests across those states in the US that have locked down, particularly Michigan. In Michigan, even some of the local sheriffs said that they refused to comply with the shelter-in-place orders issued by the Democratic governor. You can't imagine our own police showing any reluctance at all to not enforce even the most draconian lockdown measures here. I've been a bit disappointed by the reaction of the British public. You know, where are those free-born Englishmen we've heard so much about? Where are the unconquerable people that haven't been invaded since 1066? They're behaving much more like the people of the Channel Islands behave when they were invaded by the Germans during the Second World War. Informants, yeah, and lackeys. Well, not all of them, but they didn't put on a particularly good show. But I mean, other people have said, no, it's not that, you know, the British people have been emasculated by kind of metastasizing elf and safety culture. It's that we're just naturally kind of lazy couch potatoes, and given the opportunity to spend more time indoors, not exercising, eating junk food and crisps and watching rubbish on TV and being paid for it at the same time, it's, you know, people just think Christmas has come early. I think there could be an element of that too. I hope, I mean, one fear I think the government now has is that if they, when they do start to ease some of the lockdown measures and encourage people to go back to work, that people won't actually go back to work, that they've been whipped up into such a state of kind of blanket clutching fear by the bedwetting media, as well as the government, that they won't now dare venture from out under their beds and won't return to work, won't send their children to schools, and it'll take years before we get the economy back on its feet again. I hope that's not true.
Andy, as both a free-born Englishman and also a couch potato, which direction do you think you're going to go in, I mean, when all of this is over?
Well, I'm a little bit torn. I quite like the sort of communal effort that's going on. So, you know, if you go out walking in the woods, everyone seems to be very friendly. People are sort of quite friendly in shops and social distancing. And, you know, we've accepted collectively that something needs to be done to sort of look after each other and sort of deal with the consequences of this virus. And I quite like that sort of communal feel. But I'm also really worried that we are being schooled into utter passivity. So that, you know, we are, you know, well, I'm not, but some people are being, you know, paid not to work. If you've got a salary job in a big corporation or public sector and you're sent at home, you know, you're doing fine. But the people's experiences are actually very, very different. So if you, you know, you run your own business or you actually work with your hands for your trade and what have you, it's really, really tough. And I just worry that there is this sort of this acceptance that, you know, the money's just going to keep coming. The Amazon deliveries are going to carry on arriving. The shops are still going to be filled up with food. And I don't really need to do that much for it all to happen. And then I think the interesting thing is going to be when the, you know, we start to come out of this as to who is going to say, well, actually, it's not safe for me to go to work. they've sort of got pretty used to this now. And they're going to say, well, I'm not coming to the office because it's not 100% safe, or I can't go into the factory because it's not 100% safe. And I think what will be really interesting is what the unions do, whether the unions say, no, no, come on, you know, we need to get back to work and people need to earn a living. Or they'll say, no, no, well, if, you know, somebody catches the COVID and dies, then we're going to hold all the bosses responsible. So I think that's one thing to watch.
Now, Toby, as you and other listeners to this podcast may be aware, we've been compiling something of a dictionary of era-defining words. For example, we've been absolutely spoiled for choice, everything from, you know, COVID-19 to woke, you know, in the last few months. It's been an excellent old time. I was just wondering, you know, as we sort of sit here, if there was any phrase or word that really stood out for you as having sort of captured the moment of the past few weeks.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking as I've been discussing the lockdown and trying to make the case against it, just how unwise a choice of word that was for the government to choose to describe what it is they've imposed. It sounds terrible, doesn't it? A lockdown. That's the kind of thing that you normally associate with, you know, prisoners who've misbehaved, or when there's a riot in a prison, the prisoners are locked down, you know, and talk about making it absolutely blindingly obvious that we've effectively been placed under house arrest. You know, it couldn't be a kind of poorer phrase from the point of view of selling the policy. So I'm rather pleased that the government appear to have made that schoolboy error. In US states, they talk about stay-at-home orders, or even more anodyne-sounding, shelter-in-place orders. They sound a lot more appealing, sheltering in place. It sounds like there's a storm outside and you need to shelter where you are. That sounds perfectly reasonable and sensible, but locking people down, that just sounds terrible.
It sounds a little bit like the plague, doesn't it? It's a bit like any of your relations that are over 70, right? You need to herd them into the house and board them up, big black mark, let them out in 6 months' time, and just send a direct debit to Domino's to stick pizzas through their letterbox every now and again.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you use the word herd there, Andy, because I think one of the reasons, perhaps, that the government abandoned its much more sensible strategy of trying to achieve herd immunity in favour of lockdown is because herd immunity just sounded so terrible. It sounded like you were treating people like cattle, you know, that they were nothing better than cows or sheep. And, you know, a few people needed to die in order to protect the herd, you know. So I think that may have contributed to the abandonment of the poor choice of words for that strategy. But then they chose an even worse word to describe their replacement strategy. So it's baffling.
I'll be honest, I don't think it's too harsh, to be honest, to call it a herd, given that everybody's getting sort of very het up about the use of the word herd. But then if asked, are you happy with the lockdown? Absolutely, everybody just nods along in tandem going, oh yes, very happy, absolutely. We're all very happy. So, you know, I think it's got a bit of a bad rep, that herd immunity. I don't quite see why it's gained the negativity that it has in a lot of ways.
I tell you what we could do, actually, just like those the herds of cows that you find in Switzerland with the big bells around the necks, is you could have, if you've not been tested with the antibodies, you have to wear the big bell.
Like a leper.
So it's sort of clang, 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 clang. So you just avoid all the noises. It really helped people.
I do worry that mask wearing is going to be mandatory, that part of the strategy of managing the virus and making sure we avoid a second spike will be mandatory mask wearing. And even if, you know, the police don't start arresting or fining people for not wearing masks, there'll be a kind of social taboo, I think, associated with not wearing a mask. You'll be frowned upon in public, particularly on the tube or on a bus, if you haven't covered your face with a mask. So I think, you know, bells maybe not, but I think masks are going to be pretty ubiquitous for the foreseeable future.
I'll tell you what, though, if they do bring the masks in, the three of us have got to wear the mask like that plague doctor in Norwich. Sorry, you look at the old plague doctors with the beaks and the wax black coats.
Andy, what words has really stood out for you in the past few weeks?
Well, clap. Well, in the context of clap for the National Health Service, of course.
I was going to say, is there something you want to share with the class there?
Well, in the old days, if you had it, you used to go to the National Health Service. Now you stand on your doorstep and do it for the National Health Service. So I suppose the context of the word has changed somewhat over the last few weeks.
It's a very interesting segue, that, though, because we were just talking about how, you know, the masks are going to become sort of ubiquitous and everybody's going to have one. And, you know, perhaps people will get, I don't know, that sort of thing. It'll be sort of social stigma around this. But of course, we've been hearing stories about people who haven't been going onto their doorsteps to clap the NHS are being shopped to their local papers and shamed. So already we're beginning to see the sort of the social shame, the trends beginning to emerge apart from just the masks?
Well, I've got to admit, I quite liked it. When it first started out, we live in a little cul-de-sac, and it's quite a mixed sort of population in terms of age and families and what have you. And pretty much everybody comes out and claps. And when it first happened, the first week, I remember it was just we were watching Italy. It's like nothing much had happened in the UK. And I thought, it feels a little premature, this, that we're coming out and clapping anymore, because not much has happened yet. And then, you know, they've emptied the hospitals, and I've got a... In my family, my daughter and my wife work in the NHS. And my daughter said that her ward is half empty now. In fact, half the hospital's empty. They've cleared everybody out. So it's not that people are working massively hard. She's largely bored, you know, on the night shift she's come back from, actually. So I've got this sort of mixed feelings about it. I really like the communal experience. And I think people who are genuinely... you know, risking their lives and working over and beyond should, you know, that appreciation is great to give and must be fantastic to receive. And yet I sort of feel, I'm not really sure what I'm clapping for. So I stand out there now and we're all sort of clapping along and looking at each other. And I'm thinking, I bet you're clapping for someone slightly different than I'm clapping for. Maybe you're clapping for the entire institution of the NHS. Maybe I'm clapping for my daughter. Maybe you're clapping for the guy that helped you out, you know, stacked the shelves when you went to the shop. So it feels sort of, on the one hand, like a big communal experience. But it's also like, what are we? I'm not really sure what we're doing. So anyway, my word is clap.
Toby, as alluded to earlier on in the podcast, there is a certain individual who has stood out for you in the past few weeks and who you'd like to bring up and discuss. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, well, I was very disappointed to discover in the papers recently that the British police have received over 200,000 calls from members of the public reporting on their neighbours for failing to comply with the lockdown diktat. And it made me think, good Lord, you know, we've gone from being a nation of giants to becoming a nation of informants. But, you know, there is, I think, a glimmer of hope. There is still some traces of that old yeomanry of old. And one example is a fabulous individual in the suburbs of Norwich who stalks the streets in the early evening dressed as a plague doctor, complete with one of those beak-like masks. And, you know, here is the person who would be leading the resistance if we were conquered by a totalitarian state. And I think, as far as I know, the police have yet to catch up with Plague Doctor Man. He's still out there terrifying small children on the streets of Norwich. And all I can say is he is my hero of the week.
Toby, I'm sorry to break this to you, but I'm from Norwich, and that's not a man in a plague doctor outfit. That is just a doctor. You know, it's. I hate to say this, and Norwich is not the most progressive place. When you get the train back, you can feel yourself going back in time. You stare out the window and everything becomes black and white and people stop and point at you. You know, that's cutting-edge stuff there. For a very long time, of course, Norfolk was almost unique in the UK as having the last bastion, the last sort of county without any cases of COVID-19. The joke being that, you know, Norfolk wasn't quite advanced enough to have developed the infrastructure for people to get there. But all joking aside, no, it is a nice little... It is, having spoken earlier about the disappointment in many members of the British public, the sort of the acceptance of the lockdown, there is that sort of great British eccentricity, that sort of slight piss taker, that slight joker who's prepared to risk their own safety just to give us all a bit of a laugh. You know, I like that. I like that as an idea.
One of the things I've noticed is that the people who are the most reluctant to knuckle under, who are showing the greatest fighting spirit, are in fact the over 70s, the very people who are supposedly the most vulnerable to COVID-19 and the ones we're supposed to be cowering in our homes to protect. In fact, if you talk, all the over 70s I know are incredibly reluctant to stay in their homes. I'm perfectly willing to risk catching COVID-19. I don't want everyone else to kind of imprison themselves in their homes to protect me. Actually, in my street, I helped set up one of those WhatsApp groups, which are now absolutely ubiquitous across the kingdom, whereby asked for volunteers. So if any over 70s who were sheltering in place weren't able to leave their homes to do their shopping, or if they needed their dogs walking or anything like that, would people give their names, volunteer, so we could put together a little volunteer group on my street to help these poor, vulnerable over 70s. And we sent it to everyone on the street using this kind of WhatsApp group. And within seconds, we had about 50 volunteers. And I'm not exaggerating, 95% of those volunteers were over 70. And I didn't know whether it was because they'd slightly misunderstood the original request, or whether they were just kind of flicking me the V's saying, you know, off on your bike, nosy pop.
Andy, anybody that stood out for you that you want to give a shout out to?
Well, there's no one in particular, but I do want to give a bit of shout out to the people who are really enjoying the lockdown. I think there are a number of people who are secretly enjoying it, but the one group of people who very, very publicly said they're enjoying it are the goths. People who, you know, don't really like going out, don't really like other people very much, have a pretty bleak view on life and think that there's no future anyway, which is pretty much the summing up goth culture. They absolutely love it. And I was reading some blogs on the sort of goth sites, don't ask me why. and they were just sharing stories about just what an utter pleasure this lockdown is, and they just do not want it to end because they think that the rest of the world has adapted to their lifestyle. So I think let them enjoy it while it lasts, because normally they're pretty they're secretly absolutely loving it, even though they, you know, make themselves look as miserable as possible. But it didn't get me thinking that there are a lot of people out there who probably do secretly love this. I mean, there are the more obvious people like your George Monbiots of this world, who, in fact, he wrote an article the other day in The Guardian where it started off with "Do not resuscitate." And he was talking about basically industry. You know, do not resuscitate industry when we come out of this. You know, it's like, don't put a DNR notice on and pull the tubes out. So, you know, there are a number of people who think, do you know what? This is a real crisis. This is the apocalypse that I've been waiting for. And I'm just going to milk this for as much as I can. And on a serious note, I do think we need to watch that one of the trends that emerges from this sort of sense of fatalism and, hasn't it been nice that the pigeons have taken over the cities and there are no cars, that sort of thinking doesn't really predominate.
And he's quite right that various people with political agendas to push have kind of leapt on this. And one I've noticed is that the fact that there's been a disproportionately high death toll amongst Black, Asian and minority ethnic people has been leapt on by left-wing identitarians as proof of that our society is riddled with systemic racism. There was a piece in The Guardian looking into this phenomenon, and one line which we quoted in lockdownskeptics.org recently. One line was that it may be partly due to, quote, the accumulated physiological burden from the stresses caused by racism and race-related disadvantage, such as the frequent secretion of stress hormones. Now, I think we're going to be hearing a lot of this gobbledygook as the post-mortem into those who've died from COVID-19 gets underway.
Yeah. COVID-19 can kill off many things, but intersectional wokeness is one thing that it cannot, it seems. Toby, it's been informative. It's been interesting, as always. Thank you so much for coming on to That's Life. We hope that you're keeping safe. You can, of course, catch Toby every week in The Spectator in his column No Sacred Cows.
Toby's new Free Speech Union aims to advocate for those who are no platformed or targeted online for simply expressing their view. And he also has his own podcast, London Calling, which he hosts with Spectator's James Dellingpole. Do give it a listen, or find Toby on Twitter at Toadmeister.
And since Andy and I can't get up close and personal to our legions of fans these days, why not follow us too? That's at AndyShaw1 and at Benedict Spence. That's all from us. Join us for more Lockdown Frivolity on the next Spectator Life podcast. Stay safe and goodbye.